This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Roy Barsnes. I am host of the channel. And today, I get the privilege of interviewing Dr. Stephen Knobloch on his most recent work, Bodies and Rhythms, Navigating Unconscious Vulnerability and Emotional Fluidity, published by Routledge this year in 2021. This is Stephen's third book, having offered The Musical Edge of Therapeutic Dialogue in 2000 and co-authoring Forms of Inner Subjectivity in Research and Adult Treatment. Stephen has a very interesting background, and I want to introduce you to him and not keep out any of the out of the interesting background that he comes from and has risked, actually, and chosen, and how that's influenced his work. But he began his work with individuals and groups as an undergraduate volunteer with the Community Involvement Council of the University of Pennsylvania in the late 1960s, working with potential gang members and involving them in alternative, creative, and recreational activities. He also served as a student representative on a committee to support the development of the first Black Studies program at the University of Pennsylvania. In 1970, he moved to New York City, pursuing a dual career as a jazz musician and working for the Roosevelt Hospital Community Mental Health Service in welfare hotels on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. During this period, he also worked in group home and treatment program settings. When finishing his graduate studies, Dr. Knobloch coordinated the psychological services at The Door, a multi-service treatment model program from 1975 through 1981. From 81 through 88, he headed up a unit that provided training and consultative services to organizations throughout the five continents interested in replicating the program and service delivery strategies for adolescents that The Door represented as a project of United Nations, the International Center for Integrative Studies. Following the attack of 9/11 in New York City, he was recruited to serve as a clinical liaison and consultant from the New York postdoctoral program. With Feel the Music, a program of music and art workshops offered for surviving family members to facilitate recovery and resilience. In addition to his professional activities in treatment, education, and training, Dr. Knobloch continues to play jazz saxophone and study Brazilian percussion traditions, integrating these experiences into his teaching and practices. I met Steve several years ago when I invited him to conduct a seminar for the Relational Perspective Guest Lecture Series at the institution where I teach. Not only was the teaching rich, but Steve embodies his body, his very being, his presence when you are with him. And so I was also pleased that when I wrote my book, Core Competence, that Steve was willing to submit a chapter in my book on patterning and linking and utilizing his musicality and his psychoanalytic thinking on how, where, and how we come to understand our patients. As we were talking before the podcast, Steve, to me, embodied the whole idea of the body. Like, it really penetrates him. And when I read him, it does that to me too. It reminds me in my sometimes cognitive analytic mind to get back to the basics, which is my body, and to feel my patients and attend to all the micro movements and attunement and attune to that which is happening within my body in response to this patient. I was telling him that early in my career, I was exposed to Erwin Singer in his book, Key Concepts in Psychotherapy. And I was really struck with Singer when he said, pay attention to your viscera. And so viscera has accompanied me in my work for all of these years. And when I think of Steve, I think this is a man who understand something like that. And so, Steve, welcome to this podcast. I'm so pleased you'd be here. And what I'm just saying here is how much I appreciate you and how you locate your theories and practices and how they emerge from your very own being, your body, your heritage, and your own talents. Like when I read you, I know that you're a jazz man. There's a movement, there's a nuancing, there's a playing off of, and it's just really fun for me. And your work is very heady, but it's deeply grounded in who you are. And so I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit about who you are and how your very being is ever present in your work as a theorist and as a practitioner.
Well, it's hard to add to what you already have offered, but I'll touch on a few things that I think are important in terms of who I am and who I've become. And I think one is that I was born into a neighborhood. I was born to parents, but obviously living in a lower class working class neighborhood. But it was a tough neighborhood. I mean, I mentioned in my book that I was introduced into physical fights. I was initiated at 3 years old when I and my best friend were forced by the older boys to face off. And I've always just naturally from those times been probably as attuned as anybody to embodied signals of safety or danger. And I think that that's been very helpful because from the moment a patient walks into the office, into the consulting space, I feel that I'm communicating something to them with or without words. They surely are communicating something to me with or without words. And that kind of experience that I had as a child, which was a bit traumatic, to put it mildly, you know, has ultimately, with several good analyses, helped me to harness that experience in a constructive way. I think also that led me to become athletically involved. I played a lot of basketball. Where I grew up, there wasn't much to do. So, you know, you either sat on a stoop or you found something like basketball or you got in a lot of trouble. For me, I played a lot of basketball. And that's very fast moving and unpredictable, a lot of uncertainty. You know, everything's on the line all the time. You're either winning or losing. And I think that was a major factor in my developing my sensibilities. And then I think that's probably why I got attracted to jazz. Also being, you know, going to a high school where 70% of the student body was African American. So there was a lot of natural stuff happening around rhythm and blues and doo-wop and jazz. And the thing about jazz that's so great is, of course, you don't know what you're going to do next, even though you've had a lot of experience doing it. But if you get too repetitive, it's not real. It's just, you know, it's like faking it. And the real thing is to be vulnerable, to be uncertain, and to respond. But you get a real clear sense of what to do, how to play, from the way things are happening around you. So I think that was as important to my training as anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and so you introduced to us through that history of yours and the basketball and the jazz. You introduced terms such as attending to subtle embodied cues, matching and mismatching, fluidity, navigating, recognition, non-recognition, tending to micro moments of multiple affective states, patterning and linking. And your use of polyrhythmic weaving, a non-Western jazz musical concept that you refer to in your book, you know, that does not privilege, as you say in your book, the primary beat, but privilege is a meter that is fluid and recognizing and valuing contrasting rhythms. It's such a powerful metaphor in your work. Do I have that correct about in terms of polyrhythmic weaving and how you've also chosen language in your theory around very much from this idea of where you come from?
Yeah. Well, I might say it a little differently. I wouldn't say there's a primary beat. Polyrhythmic, which I've learned very well from my Brazilian teacher, who grew up in a favela and at 14 years old was trained and recruited into one of the most popular samba reggae groups in the world, Chimbalada by Carlinhos Brown, who's a kind of superstar over in Brazil, but also was a person who was very much of a community activist, and he actually developed his group out of young people in the neighborhood, and then with the success of the group, developed all kinds of educational training experiences, and the neighborhood is now no longer much of a favela. It's much more sort of middle class. But I what I learned is that it's not there, that there's a primary beat, that there are a number of beats and they weave together. And so if you try to find the center, you get lost. Or you go one way and then you miss everything else that's happening. So there's a way in which you kind of have to sort of stay open and take in, you know, you kind of, you know, find the right kind of, what do they say, you know, in music they say getting into the groove or feeling the vibe, you know. I was reading something that Racker wrote in 1968 in his Transference and Counter-Transference book. Most people only read the chapter, you know, the famous chapter, but one of the other parts of the book talks about tuning into the patient's vibration. And I was thinking, he must have been listening to the Beach Boys or something.
That's great. But that is a real marker in your work, right? Listening to the vibrations of the patient and you.
Yeah, and knowing that there are multiple strands, we're all woven out of many different influences, and to try to not be too seduced into formulating or knowing, thinking that I know things, even though it's just a knee-jerk, inevitable thing that we do. And, you know, having been privileged to go to an Ivy League school coming out of Jersey City, where I grew up, it was a traumatic couple of years before I adjusted. But I learned to use the discourses of sociology, psychology, philosophy, history. So now the challenge is how to, you know, avoid getting locked into discursive prisons, you know. And I do that. I think we all do that. We use words and we fall in love with them. So polyrhythmic is one that we could fall in love with. And they can be elucidating, but they also can be confusing and misleading. They can appear to represent something when they might oversimplify it and reduce it. And I'm always, in chapter 3 of my book, I talk about, I call it found in translation, perhaps.
Yeah, say more about that. I like it.
Well, I was starting to speak about it. I think that words sort of have at least two registers. One is they're representations of very complex experiences. And in that representing or symbolizing function, they reduce things. They lose dimensions. I mean, it's like describing sex versus having sex. I mean, you realize there's something lost going from one to the other, from the lived experience to the description. At the same time, words are embodied. I mean, a particular word can evoke a tremendous emotional response, and it can do that in terms of its familiarity or its unfamiliarity. It also can do that in terms of the volume, the tone, the pitch, the cadence of how it's pronounced. So it's complex stuff.
Yeah. So what I hear in that, and I wanted to ask you if you could say more about your idea of re-present with the re-present. And one of the, I don't know if you know the, I think 11th century mystic Meister Eckhart, but he, one of his things is, I pray to God to rid me of God. And so it's sort of what I hear you saying of, I got a term here, but as soon as I reify it, I'm going to lose it. And so how can I keep keep presenting itself in a new way and not in a reified way? I think that's what I'm hearing you say, right?
Yeah. And it's very difficult. It's challenging, but it's not impossible. And what makes it possible is others. Mm. Because I think we constantly bring a kind of a sense of surprise, a sense of unknownness. Steve Mitchell wrote about this in his last book, Can Love Last, where he suggested it's not familiarity. The traditional idea of familiarity breeds contempt that gets in the way of difficulties in, you know, connecting emotionally with another. What gets in the way is the more we get to know another, the more we realize how much we don't know the other.
Yeah, that's nice.
And I think our challenge as analysts is to recognize that we're going to find that place in ourselves and in our patients where that fear is evoked, and then to stay in that fear, in the way that Winnicott, you know, talks about surviving annihilation. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's a fear of annihilation, actually.
Yeah.
But I think that uncertainty, vulnerability, is not easy. You know, I can preach it.
Exactly, right?
But I don't practice it any better than anybody else. It's very right. difficult. But I think we all, you know, when I think of my colleagues' work, the best work comes in those moments when, not when we think we know, but when we know that we don't know.
Yeah.
And then we open ourselves up to something new emerging.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when I'm hearing that is when we think we know our patients, in a sense, we've lost them, right? Because we've now limited to, oh, this is what they are. And this is the idea, the problem sometimes with interpretation versus dialogue, or the relational dialogue that was introduced, where we're, oh, in fact, you say something about this in the book, and I'd like you to say more about it. The idea of containment, that containment shuts the fluidity down. But say, can you say more about that, actually?
Well, I think it's kind of riding that wave of paradox that we're trying to get at as we try to use words together to evoke this this experience. And I think that it's very important. I mean, clearly we need to have orientation, and we need to have cognitive awareness of our place and relationship to each other in our communities, professional, social. But every time we kind of have a dimension of our identity sort of locking in, it has the potential, and often does, block further growth. You know, there was a definition of masculinity in 1954 that changed in 1964, that changed in 1974, et cetera. And it keeps changing. And who I think I am in relationship to that definition, or, you know, the definition that I think I have of it, keeps changing. But at the same time, we need those anchors. We need those oriented places, placements. You know, we place ourselves socially, racially, ethnically, professionally. You know, I'm an early career development. I'm a senior, you know, teaching person or whatever.
Yeah, well, I think that's what I was in the first question I had around you is that the beauty of your work to me is that you have reflected upon your Stevenness, if you will, like where you come from, what you are, who you are, what your talents are, and that's that idea I think of we. To be able to be a good musician or improvisationalist, we can't do that unless we know where we stand. And one of the things that I know I'm teaching a lot about these days is in order to do this work, you have to be located. You've got to know you've got to have not know yourself, but receive yourself. And in that, then you can be dislocated by the music of your patient or by the things that begin to come your way or change you. And I think that's what's striking to me in your writings and in your personhood is you kind of know who you are. And by being there, you're able to be shifted around a bit.
That's interesting. I have to think about that. But I think for sure that however you achieve it to the degree possible, the key is to be open to that shift. And I think, I don't know whether it's more difficult. I think it's more difficult on two ends of the spectrum, when you become too overwhelmed with trauma or when you become too overwhelmed with power. I think those are two things which can significantly get in the way of that openness and that continuing to change, the need to continually change. And the richness of emotional, interpersonal, collective experience that comes from that ability to ride the wave of unfolding life.
Yeah, yeah. When we were, and before I want to go into that, is there anything else you want to say to the listener about the body and its role within doing a in treatment? Because so often we, I believe, are cut off and psychotherapy in general is trafficked sort of as a cognitive exercise.
That's right.
And you are coming.
Yeah.
And you are coming and saying, I don't think so. I think it begins in the body. And I'm wondering if you want to say and help us understand more of this powerful idea.
Well, I think,
to us.
Yeah, I guess if you think of what you just said as psychotherapy emerging in the Americas, out of the psychoanalytic movement in Europe, and Freud's initial technique, which was to try to make us aware of what we're unaware of because of shame or guilt, then we start with a real powerful focus on consciousness and on cognitive functioning. And we've moved, and I know that in my lifetime, there's been so many related therapies that have developed, a lot of body-based therapies where people manipulate the body or bring attention to the body. My sense is, I guess, somewhere, I think there's value to that work, but I'm saying that in our work of helping a patient to face into the trauma that's keeping them from living more fully, that attending to their body and the micro dimensions of that, their gaze, does it meet your gaze? Does it avert your gaze? Does it go to the floor? Does it go to the ceiling? Their facial expression, how frozen is it? How evocative is it? How evocative of sadness or laughter, humor, and their movement. A lot of people speak with their hands, and they move their head and lean forward and back, and breathing, we're aware of breathing and pace. Some people take, very fast and they're in the staccato when they talk. And other people really do something, like this, with a little pickup in staccato. And most of us are moving back and forth or, through different versions of that. And it gives a lot of information about how we're feeling. And so, not that we should just pay attention to, my emphasis is not just pay attention to our patients, but to pay attention to ourselves. Because one thing we've learned from relational psychoanalysis and the interpersonalists, and even from Freud with the idea of transference and countertransference, is that what we're experiencing is very much influenced by what our patient is experiencing. Now, I'm not going to say that, everything that we experience is projected into us from our patients. Some of it might be. It's worth wondering. It's worth wondering if my chest begins to tighten, whether I'm picking up something in my patients, becoming fearful and becoming a bit more constricted. And I think those wonderings are good. I'm not a big fan of saying, well, the back of my neck started to hurt, so it made me think of my patient's potential sexual abuses. You know, I wouldn't make it so concrete, but I would wonder, you know, what does this mean? Is this something that we're getting into together? And that's what I'm feeling like when you get into the water and it's cold or it's warm. So that's the value of attention to our bodies. And it's not easy, you know, and we're not trained to do it for the most part in our psychoanalytic institutes.
Yeah. And in general psychology either, because when you were talking, you were talking about, you know, observing our patient's body, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing that you add to all of that is, as we're attending to that patient's body, we're not objectifying them in a sense and saying that's what they're doing. We're saying, how is my experience of their body now finding itself in my body?
That's right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that's really powerful, isn't it? But it's what a major shift, because in so many ways we're saying, oh, the patient must be feeling this because their eyebrow did that. And you're saying, no, how did that eyebrow hit you? And what might that have to do with the patient? It's right. A whole paradigm shift in terms of the work.
That eyebrow raise might have all of a sudden alerted me, you know, drawn my attention in a direction I would have not gone if I was just thinking, what is the patient saying? What is the patient meaning? And not paying attention to the patient's eyebrow.
Yep. And another aspect of relationality, and that I also hear in your work, is that we're also being read. Our bodies are being read.
All the time.
And how do we invite the patient to be able to speak about what they're reading, right?
That's right. That's right. And that's very complex, because often you cannot have a conversation with words about that. You have to allow it to unfold, because the patient could easily not be with you. You have to go slowly. Like, what are you talking about? You know, they might feel attacked, accused. So it's an interesting process. It takes a lot of patience, but it takes a lot of careful vigilance. But, you know, like any other kind of practice, if you do it enough, you can relax into it, and it becomes something that is easier the more you do it.
Actually, absolutely, right?
And I think people forget that when we all started learning how to be clinicians, it wasn't easy. And, no. You know, all you have to do is supervise somebody who's in there, you know, still not, you know, in their graduate level. And you realize how many things that you take for granted that they're still learning.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, I also think in terms of music, it's like playing guitar or saxophone. The more you do it, the more things come into your awareness that you can do with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Taking me all the way back to my dissertation, where I was evaluating what I would, my subjects were teachers teaching in the People's Republic of China just after it opened up. And the only scale of all the scales that I offered them through the 16PF, the MMPI, et cetera, that actually had any kind of meaning was the idea of intuition. The people who were high on the intuition scale had more success in the first 6 months in another culture than if they were using their cognitions. And I think that's what you're, as we develop that comfortability with, like, let me intuit my way through this, to improvise and to play, we're going to be a lot more, it's going to be an easier job in a way, and a much more rich one.
Yeah, two things. One is, it's not, this idea isn't original. I hope expanding and extending ideas such as Winnicott's idea of play, which is so powerful. Mm-hmm. And also the point you made about, maybe 3 points. The second being, to intuit is really, I don't know if we really have a good translation of what that means.
No, I agree.
I think it has something to do with being touched by the other person.
Nice.
You know, I mentioned mm-hmm. Bruce Reese's idea that embodied communication, what the infinite researchers talk about on these micro dimensions, micro moment dimensions of shifting of gaze or accent or pause in speech,
mm-hmm.
that he calls that the patient's address. You know, the patient's address.
Yes.
It's not only a way of saying in the interaction, this is who I am, this is what I'm working on, this is what I'm traumatized by.
Mm-hmm.
It's also an invitation.
Yeah.
Invitation, like, and it's saying, are you wanting to do this? Do you really want to pay attention to me? You really want to go here with me?
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yes, I like that word. And when I read it in your book with Reese, and the idea of being addressed, and is, will we respond to the invitation? And I think something that grieves me a bit in psychotherapy is often in our own fears and anxieties, when a patient says, here I am, we go, well, stay right there. I want to take control of the invitation now, as opposed to, well, what are you inviting me to?
Right. Well, that gets to an issue which I address in a number of the clinical examples. I think I illustrated in the clinical examples in each of the chapters, pretty much, which is that a key issue in the work is when the patient feels a sense of power. And in order to do that, they have to feel that in relationship to us. That means that we are not the one who has the power in those moments.
Right, right.
They're directing what happens. They have more of an influence on how we feel than we have on how they feel, although it's fluid. You know, mm-hmm. It could happen in a tenth of a second, or it could happen over, you know, 5 or 10 sessions.
Yeah.
Again, there's uncertainty, there's vulnerability there, which is, you know, these are my battle cries.
Yeah. I want to take us to, I want to make sure we get to the section of the last chapter of the book, because that is a wild chapter, I must say. Mm-hmm. But I know in one of our last correspondence, you had just finished a webinar with IARP.
That's
and
right.
You were very excited about it and said that ideas were flowing out of you. And I know of that experience when we speak. And in fact, this is a good example that if we are engaged in our speaking events, we become immersed in it, and we receive back far much more than what we even prepared when we went, right? And so you said your mind was just flowing. So I kind of don't want to interrupt that flow and let you riff for a moment.
Okay.
On what did you experience during that webinar, and what do you want to bring to us?
I think it was kind of like a microcosm of my career.
Nice.
And I think it's something that is more or less universal. And that was the frustration of not being able to really find words, which the whole book, my whole career, and I think all of our careers, all of our theorizing, and even when we just work with local theories with our patients, what does this mean? You know, how do you say it? How do I say it? That something is always getting lost in translation.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. People in the webinar, and of course, these are analysts from all over the world who are interested in this. They chose to be in the webinar. Right. You know, we're struggling with what the different meanings of some of these words, like polyrhythmicity, or when I used, words from Frantz Fanon, like lactification or petrification.
Right.
What do they mean, and how well do they really capture what they're trying to represent or present. And it became so clear because here were, you know, there were about 75 folks who really were motivated. I mean, can you imagine having a class of 75 people who want to be there? sometimes we get seminars of 3, 4, 5, 8, you know. And there was a lot of difficulty with that. And I was challenged to try to walk away from those words, which I have a kind of love affair with, as I've learned them or helped to develop them, and try to just speak in terms of lived experience, which is what I think if I could judge myself, I think I'd do that better when I start narrating a clinical moment.
Like you did in chapter four with, or not in the chapter four, chapter seven, I think it is, right, with Anon?
Well, that's six. Yeah. But yes. Yeah.
So I want to ask you a couple things. One is, for the person who's going to pick up this book and they're going to go to chapter six, they're going to go, holy Moses, what do I do with these words? So why don't you do your best at breaking down epidermalization and petrification, latification and phantomization. Come on, Steve. Oh, give us a break.
Do I have 15 weeks? And
No, you have, one, two, there's four words. You get 4 seconds on each one.
Oh, yeah. Well, these are, I get talk about translation. These are the English translators of the French original language that Fanon used, which was not his original language, as he was born in Martinique.
Right.
And so this is the best I can do as to what he was meaning in the way I use it. Let's see. Let me start with epidermalization.
Sure.
Because this brings us into the other part of the book, bodies and social rhythms. The social being, I think it's, to use a term that the African philosopher, writer, Achille Mbembe uses, I think to talk about the social, we need to think not of linearity, non-linearity, but reticularity, which is the way that finer and finer networks exist in which we are an active part. We are, so rather than think of identity as some kind of cohesive coming together, to think in terms of all the different fine network ways in which we are experiencing ourselves and experienced by others. I was talking about this with Stephen Hartman the other day, and he pointed out something that Katie Gentile always reminds us of, is that when we talk about ourselves in our world, we forget that we don't pay attention to the inanimate world, what we call the inanimate world, which is really actually very alive. And for example, we think of politics, we think of gender, we think of race. We don't think of the fact that honeybees, without honeybees, we all might be dead.
Right.
Yeah. So the epidermalization is the idea that the color of skin becomes a marker of subjectivity. And a very powerful one, because for people who don't have white skin, they have been considered historically by people who do as inferior. And even though some of us, many of us, have been educated to think of that, well, that was an inaccurate anthropological mistake, which the anthropologists corrected themselves in the late 19th century, those kinds of thinking and the political and economic and social implications of that still live on in our lives, often unconsciously even.
Well, so if I understand that correctly, the idea epidermalization is it particularity within a network?
It's a particular way in which one becomes marked. And stereotyped.
Okay. All right.
In the same way that we might do it with gender. Oh, she's a woman. of course. He's a man, of course. Yeah. And then we have this general stereotypic, oh, he's from Africa. Oh, she's from Asia, And and that's supposed to mean that we understand a whole lot of things that are true of everybody, who's ethnically or gender or racially or other, socioeconomically class, I come from Jersey City. So what do you expect? Kind of thing.
Right. Exactly.
And I had to live with that for a long time, feeling like I didn't deserve to be respected because I didn't know what the heck was going on. I came from Jersey City.
Yeah.
So that's the epidermological.
Petrification.
Petrification. What Fanon meant by that is, and I think it's really important, it's not the same thing that we mean when we talk about dissociation. He talked about the way that the kinds of beliefs and practices which make up and then which permeate the discourse, the language, lead to a kind of freezing and a deadening of possibility for someone who's been abjected.
Yeah.
So that could be a woman, it could be a child, it could be a person of a different race.
Well, and it also comes back, I think, to our earlier conversation, even around words, where how we will petrify our own traditions, our own cultures.
That's right.
And we become denominational and categorical and all those things. Good.
Right.
Lactification. Sounds like Kleinian breastfeeding.
Yeah. Well, lactification came from one of his translators. I think it was in the latter. There are two major translations, and I'm not remembering the names of the translator. But in Black Skin, White Masks, which is probably, it's one of the two most influential books by Frantz Fanon, and the one that has so much that can speak to psychoanalysts and psychotherapists, particularly about race and about identity, about recognition. He's pretty good with that. And the idea of lactification was that there's this belief, unconsciously often carried through social norms by both the colonizer and the colonized, or the oppressor and the oppressed, the one who's more powerful, the one who's less powerful, but they both share the belief that to be white is best and that to be not white is to be inferior.
Yeah.
There's a couple of folks in our field, Eng and Han, who wrote a book about Asian immigration. And they talked about the Asian attempt to assimilate. And they used a description, which I think they may have even used these words, where the Asian would feel they would assimilate, they would be successful in so many ways, but so they would consider themselves white, but not quite.
Yeah.
And just the fact that you have to have that as a marker,
Yeah.
And let's face it, it's in many cultures, there are those kinds of markers. But that's what he meant. That's what he meant by lactification, that both the colonizer and the colonized believe that, that and are haunted by that.
Yeah. Toni Morrison said, in this country, American means white. Everybody else has to hyphenate. And that kind of takes us to what you're saying, I think.
Yeah. We don't think of ourselves as Euro-Americans.
No. No, it's the con. Yeah. So phantomization.
Let me thank people like the young Daniel Butler, whose just name is just kind of breaking in psychoanalytic theories, wrote an incredible paper about this. And it was basically his distinction between fantasy, the fantastic, and the phantomatic. So fantasy is something that we carry in our imaginations, right? It's our way of representing things, and it sometimes has more or less verticality with lived experience. but we speak of fantasy. It's Kleinian notion. The phantomatic is the idea that something is there.
I think to point out to our listeners, because they can't see it, but it's the PH phantomatic, right, that you're talking, right, and not right. The fantastic FA, right?
Like phantom, yeah. Phantom, as yeah. opposed to phantasm. Right. And the phantom is a presence of an absence. Francisco Gonzalez, in discussing Daniel's work, calls it like a phantom limb effect.
Yeah.
So we have sense that something there, but it's not there. Yep. We have a sense of some of the presence of absence. That's the best way to put it. And what Fanon is saying is that when he worked with his patients, and he was very influenced by Freud, and he read Freud and Jung and Lacan. He was very influenced by Lacan. He was saying that my work is not just to have the patient remember, it's to remember their history, the history mm-hmm. which has been amputated through a kind of petrification process, so that it exists phantomatically. And there are people like Kirkland Vaughan and Kathy Polk White and others who are African-American colleagues of ours who write about the presence of slavery, of the history of slavery, not just in the consciousness and unconscious of patients of color, but also all of us. Yeah. And of course, now it's more out there also in the socio-political discourses.
So good. So in this chapter, in our last few minutes that we have, you talk about this patient. And one of the powerful things, given these terms, by the way, that's really... You just did a good teaching on that chapter. So good job. Well,
tried to translate.
good job. But one of the things that struck me that is so important to me in our culture and race relations, et cetera, is a concept that you're introducing there, is the concept of non-recognition. That is powerful to me in terms of advancing our conversations, not only in psychotherapy. I would say that basically all psychoanalysis is a misread, and we're trying to get a better read. And if we could apply that to culture as well, but you know, we have cultural competency classes and what have you, and it's just like that doesn't work, and it's a misrecognition. And you introduced to us the power of transformation through non-recognition in this chapter. I loved it. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit briefly about the case and how you came to understand that concept within this case.
Well, I have to say, let me give credit to reading the recent work of Sally Swartz, who is very from South Africa, a psychoanalyst from South Africa. Mm. It's really, you know, I've been in ongoing dialogue with Sally, and her ideas have really been helpful. And the other place where I've been helped is actually toward the end of Black Skin, White Masks, Fanon discusses Hegel, and he talks about recognition of the black man. And I think it applies to almost every group that feels somewhat othered. You know, a person with a physical disability or, you know, ADHD. I work with a lot of patients who feel very less than human with that. And also race and gender. And what Fanon said is, in order to recognize, the recognition that Hegel describes is recognition in terms of the one who has the power. It's recognition in terms of their discourse. So, you know, I might say, well, you can, you know, you're pretty strong physically, but you're not that good with mathematics. So I don't think as much of you. But, you know, why is one more significant than the other? They're both very important. And, you know, we all are somewhere on a continuum with regard to both of them. So his main point was that recognition seems to always be culturally contextualized. In whose terms are we being recognized?
Yeah.
And this is one of the, you know, the limitations. It doesn't take anything away from Jessica Benjamin's great theorizing about recognition and about the doer and the done to. But the question then arises, in what context, with what terms, you know? Yeah. And so, for example, to make it a little bit more concrete, a patient who is getting angry and is often interpreted as resisting may in fact be expressing some kind of liberating vitality to express their agency that you have generated for them.
Right.
You have not made them angry. You've given them the power. You've given over your power to allow them a wider range of their emotional expression and saying, mm-hmm. I'm not going to be destroyed. You know, as Winnicott points out, the good uh-huh. mother, the appropriate mothering response is not to be annihilated.
Right.
Taking the message, you know, and then we could go to all kinds of other, you know, alpha, beta, you know, beyond ideas. But to realize that recognition is very tricky, can be culturally yeah. relative. And that all, well, I was going to say that non-recognition can be more powerful. To exactly. accept that you don't understand the other person is to give them that agency of yep. being opaque.
Yep.
This is something that Edward Glissant, who's an amazing writer from the Caribbean, writes about opacity.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't generally value that. We, you know, you really have to see everything and understand everything. And and you should be open. Well, I mean, we don't walk around naked.
Right. Well, it's the same kind of thing that I fight against a little bit. It was the idea of rupture and repair. It's like we get it all good. We have a rupture, but we make it good. And we make it good because from my context, I saw you. And what was powerful about your case is the non-recognition. I'm wondering if you can just say a little bit about how that happened between you and your patient and it feels like it's still in process, but.
Yeah, I think it's unfolding. But the particular micro moment that I described was when it was very mundane. The patient was struggling with some decision with his girlfriend about where to live. And I was, you know, focusing in on, well, let's look at some strategies. And, you know, at one point he just looked at me and said, "You don't get it. You know,
yeah.
I'm black. You know, where I live as a black person has a lot to do with it." I mean, I'm paraphrasing it.
Yeah.
And rather than fight him or apologize, I just, you know, I just took in my body's response to that. And I felt that in retrospect, and, you know, in the moment, I had no capacity for reflection other than to pause. But I felt my pause probably reflected a kind of place where I couldn't place myself, where he's trying to show me that he can't place himself. And his observation of my struggle, more than anything else, I think, was communicated that he had impacted me, that I
yeah. got,
there was nothing I could say, nothing I could do other than allow him to experience my loss of professional, you know, equilibrium, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, and it gave him a sense of his own power. And, you know, as yeah. I mentioned, without going into a lot of detail, subsequently and continuing to this day, he's increasingly come into awareness and expression of his own agency in so many different yeah. ways.
Yeah. What's coming to my mind, Steve, is you're not getting it, got it. So in a weird way, non-recognition becomes recognition and empowering.
Yeah. You could.
He felt seen.
Yeah, those words work as well. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. Exactly. We're trying. I'm trying. Well, Steve, it's been wonderful to be together. And I'm wondering if you have any last words for the listeners of the podcast today.
Well, let's see. If I step back from everything we're talking about today, I would say, a word comes to mind. I would say that a word that we need to allow into our lexicon as clinicians, as helpers, people wanting to rescue folks suffering in trauma, is struggle.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't expect, and in fact, if we're not struggling, something isn't right.
Yeah.
And learning to struggle is, I think, essential to life. We somehow have this world where we are creating all these technologies so everything will be done for us or made it easy for us. I'm not against that. I love them myself, including my lawnmower. but it's a struggle sometimes with the lawnmower. When we come out of our mother's womb, we struggle to breathe. We struggle to move. We struggle to figure out what the fuck is going on.
Right.
I don't think it changes much. The terms and the surroundings change, but I think it's okay. I think that's good. I think that makes life worth it. It makes it feel good and real.
Yeah.
You know, it also sometimes makes it feel really bad and unreal.
Yeah.
But I think struggle is the word that today's discussion brings forth, now that you asked.
Mm. Steve, thank you so much. It's been a very rich time to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to see you again, Roy, and thank you for spending this time with me.